Good evening. Thank you very much for coming to the 7th annual debate held by the Family Justice Council. My name is Tessa Fife. I work in the Council Secretariat. It falls upon me just to deal with a few short housekeeping matters. I'm told that there aren't any fire alarms due this evening. Should there be a fire alarm, if you could make your way out of this door or that door, the fire exit signs are very clearly signposted, and we'll be walking along the corridor, down the stairs, and we'll be guided by somebody with a Lion Court conference umbrella, who will take us to the point where we have to assemble. The ladies' toilets are nearest to us here, just outside of the double doors, and the men's toilets are the other side of the lift. We're still expecting a few people, but I think it's time that we start. So without further ado, I'd like to hand over to the panel.
Tessa, of course, has done the important business, at least as far as the health and safety executive is concerned. Welcome to all of you. As you know, this is the 7th annual debate staged by the Family Justice Council. There was much discussion on the council as to what the topic should be, and eventually we decided, with particular input from Professor Anne Barlow, that the topic should be mediation, which is a very topical topic. The speakers, who I'm not going to introduce, I'm going to leave it to them to make such introductory comments explaining their expertise and interest in the topic as they think appropriate. But our speakers all have an interest, a professional interest in the topic, and I'm sure we're going to have a very interesting debate. And the format, for those of you who have not been to one of these debates before, is that each of our speakers will speak either in support or opposition to the motion for between 12 and 15 minutes. The organisation, of course, is so incompetent that the clock is behind the speakers, so they won't know whether they're running out of time. But we aim to finish that part of the proceedings by about 6:30. And at that point, there will be a general discussion. There will be roving mics. Anybody can stand up and ask a question or make an observation. The motion before us is mediation fit for the purpose? In support of the motion, I'll ask Sarah Lloyd to speak first.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sarah Lloyd, and I have two roles. I am the Consultant Director of Dispute Resolution at Resolution, and I'm also currently the Director of the Family Mediation Council. It's an honour and a privilege for me to have this opportunity to speak to such a skilled and experienced audience tonight, and I have to say it's also a little bit daunting. I'd like to thank the Family Justice Council for this invitation, and obviously I'd also like to extend my thanks to the President and to the fellow members of the panel, and may the best team win. I do hope that over the course of the next hour we will identify for you, more importantly, some aspects of mediation which would benefit from further and wider debate, and thus reach out to the whole mediation community in our ongoing conversations. It's the 5th of November and bonfire night, and I can't speak for my fellow speakers, but I, for one, don't have any fireworks to let off tonight, and I hope you're not too disappointed. But I do anticipate that in keeping with the traditions of the day, we will have an illuminating and sparkly debate, and whilst there may not be a plot, there is a plan, and we do hope to provide you with sufficient food for thought and discussion to ensure that if you turn down an invitation to a dazzling fireworks party in favour of a debate on mediation, you made the right choice. Mediation is alive and well and available today, tomorrow, and in the future, and is not going to disappear in a puff of smoke, unlike the fireworks that displays all over the country tonight. The title of our debate this evening is Mediation Fit for the Purpose? And I'm speaking for the motion. Whose purpose? What purpose? Mediation may be fit for one person's purpose, but not for another. I'd just like to spend a little bit of time examining this from two different perspectives and answering what I hope will be two simple questions. Firstly, is mediation fit for purpose? Obviously, that's the title of our debate. And then a closely related question, and one perhaps which is more important or interesting, or certainly one which we might wish to debate further, which is, are mediators fit for purpose? So, to my first question, is mediation fit for purpose? What purpose are we referring to? And indeed, would everyone in this room be able to agree on what that purpose is, let alone whether mediation is fit for it? The purpose of mediation, well, here are just a few suggestions that I've got. Maybe its purpose is to keep separating couples out of court. Maybe it's to provide a further process option in the toolkit of the family justice professional. Maybe it's to save the government money, or to empower separating couples to take control of and make decisions about their future, and more importantly, perhaps, their children's future. So the purpose of mediation might be different depending on who you're asking. Separating couples, mediators, government, courts, children. And it must be fit for the purpose of more than one group of stakeholders, perhaps. I propose that there is a very simple solution to this. Go back to the beginning and answer the following question. What problem was mediation designed to address? And I would suggest that the answer to that is that it was designed to address and to assist separating couples by providing a safe place for them to identify the issues they need to discuss which arise as a result of their separation, and then to help them to consider how they might resolve those issues in order for both of them to move on with their lives, and crucially and of paramount importance where children are involved, for the children's needs to have been properly addressed and taken into account. And I think we do also need to bear in mind that mediation will not necessarily be a suitable process for all separating couples, and that the assessment process should identify those for whom it would not be appropriate, and there are a number of reasons why that might be, and that the assessment process must also make it clear to separating couples that each of them must come voluntarily to the mediation table, and again, this will rule some couples out. And if, despite appearances, separating couples do not really want to reach consensus, and some don't, or are not ready to reach consensus because it's just not the right moment, then mediation won't ever be fit for their purpose, and they may consider that time spent in mediation is time wasted. And if couples try to reach consensus through mediation but don't manage to, then they may feel that mediation wasn't fit for their purpose either. So, my contention is that, let's keep it simple, mediation is intended to provide a safe, non-threatening forum for suitable separating couples who wish to avail themselves of an opportunity to discuss issues and concerns arising as a result of their separation and to reach consensus. And of course, it may also help others, such as parents who've never lived together, grandparents and wider family. And it is abundantly clear that mediation is fit for purpose. So let's not interfere with the mediation purpose and the core principles that govern it. It's crucial that the mediation process is not hijacked by any other interested parties in order to ensure that it remains fit for purpose. Mediation must remain a voluntary process which can help separating families reach sensible, pragmatic and workable decisions about their future. And in doing so, it will remain fit for purpose. Moving on to my second question. Are mediators fit for purpose? Are mediators fit to deliver this service of mediation to separating couples? In an effort to examine this question, I want to touch briefly on the development of the mediation profession in England and Wales. The process was introduced to this country several decades ago and was enthusiastically welcomed by diverse groups of professionals at different times. These professionals were involved sometimes peripherally in the family justice system, and they underwent mediation training with one of the member organisations set up often specifically to address the particular needs of specific groups of professionals. As a result of the way in which mediation was introduced, mediators can and do frequently come from quite different professional backgrounds. This has many advantages and can work to the advantage of separating couples who are able to choose, for example, a mediator who has specific expertise in an area which is of particular importance to them. This may be of a financial nature, or perhaps they have expertise in helping with children issues. And there can be many other things for which this is really important. The diverse professional backgrounds from which mediators are drawn contributes to the richness and the diversity of the process and has inevitably posed significant challenges on the mediator's umbrella body. That body, the Family Mediation Council, is now tasked with the development of the mediation profession, and it's clear that the member organisations already have high standards in place which their mediators must meet. The concern, if there is one, is that those standards may differ, but perhaps it's right that they do. And I'm not proposing to examine that today, but I think it's a really interesting topic for a future debate. Let me explain briefly a little bit about the FMC. Its board is made up of representatives from the main mediation member bodies, together with currently one independent member, but soon hopefully more. It was formed in 2007, and one of its main aims on formation was to enable mediators through their organisations to speak equally and with one voice. Since 2007, the landscape really has changed, and the speed with which that has happened has been quite dramatic. Calls for mediation standards to be harmonised have resulted in an increased need for mediation organisations through the Family Mediation Council to develop the profession by putting in place standards common to all their family mediator members. The Council quickly recognised the need for action, and under the leadership and guidance of Deborah Turner, the convener of the FMC until her retirement at the end of last year, commissioned an independent review of its functions. As an aside, I'd just like to take this opportunity to acknowledge Deborah's enormous contribution during her time as convener. The review of the FMC was published in the summer of 2012. The Council broadly accepted the recommendations of the review and is now already in the process of carrying out some of those recommendations and looking, together with a specialist consultant, at how other recommendations might be structured and funded. That consultant has already reported and has already found that many of the building blocks which assist the required development are already in place, because the mediation organisations have separately and voluntarily carried out this very important work on regulating standards for their own mediator members over many years. In particular, standards of training and ongoing year-on-year membership renewal requirements are already very well embedded in the work of the organisations, and so the report proposes that a work programme comprising small groups of experts drawn from the family mediation community, supported where necessary by an external specialist, will be needed to draw together sets of accessible standards in relation to, for example, initial training, pre-accreditation practice, assessment and accreditation. And as much of the work in these areas has already been done by the mediation organisations individually, much of the work of the small groups will simply be to draw together that work, collate existing standards, and produce, where appropriate, single standards in the identified areas. I should mention that the consultant the board retained recognised that the family mediation profession already had an enviable system of supervision via its professional practice consultants, which other areas of mediation might do well to look at more closely. So the FMC has, since its formation, already carried out significant work in a number of areas over the years that it's been formed, putting together a code of practice, for example, for mediators, which was agreed by all the organisations and has now been in place for some time. On the competency front, in consultation with the legal aid agency, the FMC has carried out a thorough review of the assessment of the professional competence, or APC, scheme, and worked on upgrading that scheme, which is now in place with the approval of the LAA and is operational and working well. This scheme, together with a similar Law Society scheme, also provides very visible evidence of the competence of mediators and their fitness for purpose at the appropriate post-training point. And of course, the constitution of the council, which founding members put in place back in 2007, had already set out minimum entry standards required for all the organisations wishing to have a place on that council. The council is currently working on a code of conduct for PPCs, which will provide a framework of support for the important supervisory work that PPCs carry out. Data has also now been collected from the member organisations, and work on a family mediator database is almost complete. Work on erasing duplication on the database, which I'm reliably told is called deduping, is being carried out, and the FMC will now be considering how best to deliver a database which needs to be accessible and have a search capability easily accessible to members of the public. So in summary, much has already been achieved to evidence the fitness for purpose of mediators. More is being done and further work is anticipated. And all members of the FMC board are working together in order to ensure that this work is delivered. And what we have to do, obviously, is to devise a standard means of evidencing fitness for purpose, because that is clearly the link which is missing. So, mediators are fit for purpose. I contend that they're fit for purpose. Clearly, if they're fit for purpose and mediation is fit for purpose, there's not very much more to say, but I would like to say just one more thing. This is challenging work. I can't help but draw a comparison with the mediation process itself. Mediation is hard work for the separating couple. They need to participate fully and to take responsibility for the decisions they're making for their own future. Mediators, the member organisations and the FMC must take responsibility for the mediation's ongoing fitness for purpose, and equally crucially must take responsibility for its future success. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Liz and I, when preparing briefly for these presentations, discussed whether or not we should be wearing our tin hats and body armour. But I am quite sure that I come to an audience with a very open mind about this topic. And I want to make it clear from the outset that I am a believer. I've been an accredited family law mediator for 17 years, and over that time, I've been privileged to be part of some truly transformative experiences for couples and consequently their children. I remain shiny-eyed about mediation as a process, but, and this causes me quite some sadness, I do not feel that it is currently fit for purpose. I will argue that this relates to two main problems: the structural weakness and the difficult external environment. Let me first tackle the thorny issue of structure, both in terms of the regulatory framework, but also within the mediation industry. Mediation had its genesis in the charitable and not-for-profit sector, where it developed very much a local and non-commercial basis. Although it has been partially commercialised over the preceding couple of decades, it has not, in my view, ever been professionalised. At this point, I want to drop behind the lectern before you throw things at me. Let me make myself clear about what I mean. I don't want to be overly provocative, but I want to be clear that most mediators I know operate in an entirely professional and ethical manner. What I'm trying to argue is that the lack of proper regulatory framework, and I would say the consequent weakness of the quasi-regulatory and standard-setting body that the Family Mediation Council, which, you know, I do applaud for the work that it has been doing in very difficult circumstances, together with the lack of consensus in the representative bodies, has led, I'm afraid, to an industry that is not currently fit for purpose. There are six bodies representing and regulating mediators. Arguably, from a consumer perspective, that's far too many. A multiplicity of bodies makes for consumer confusion. How do they know which ones to choose or what differentiates them? Also, in a properly regulated environment, the larger the number of bodies, the greater the duplication and the higher the cost for the regulated community. Without size and scale and consequent resource, the representative bodies struggle to properly fulfil their role. And the Family Mediation Council is almost wholly dependent on those representative bodies to function. So the whole edifice is a rather shaky house of cards. Without clarity, consensus and implementation of a unified
codified and properly regulated set of standards, training and regulation, mediation will continue to struggle. In my opinion, a standard setting and regulatory body with statutory authority is required to bring mediation onto the level playing field with other legal and dispute resolution options. In its absence, we're left without the structural safety nets which guarantee consumer redress and which boost consumer confidence in the process. If we do not have unified standards and redress or disciplinary mechanisms, then we do ourselves no favours with all the key stakeholders and the public. If we want to be credible, we need to get our house in order. Public confidence, and therefore the propensity to consider mediation, can surely be promoted in this way. My second argument relates to the structure of the mediation industry itself. The way mediation is organised and delivered in England and Wales is fragmented, a cottage industry of supplier base. There are many sound reasons why mediation services were, in the main, small, geographically focused operations staffed by people with a true vocational zeal for the practice of mediation. But the process itself, as currently constituted, has been largely face-to-face and therefore has obvious constraints. However, for mediation to be fit for purpose in the future, the shape of the industry and the arrangements of the current supplier base pose significant challenges. Individual mediation suppliers and services will continue to struggle to address the twin problems of mediation, both of which relate to public awareness and understanding. I would suggest that it is way beyond the capacity and the pockets of individual or groups of mediation suppliers to address this difficulty. Without a significant drip-drip concerted public education campaign coordinated by central government to raise awareness of mediation, leading, as I said before, to consideration of the service, the resolution of ordinary people's family law problems, it will never, I'd argue, be successful in embedding itself in the public psyche. Publicising the availability of mediation and educating the public as to its benefits is essential for functioning and fit-for-purpose system. Likewise, education must be extended to the legal profession, encompassing lawyers and judges, to ensure that they are aware of the benefits both they and their clients stand to gain. Of course, we know that no such public education campaign is proposed now or in the future. The Ministry of Justice has put together, I consider, a rather sweet and quite helpful YouTube video, you know, the one with the birds? But that is the limit of the promotion of mediation as a central way to resolving family law problems. So with nothing else on the cards and no resource in the private or not-for-profit sector to fund this sort of activity, mediation is surely on the back foot. And of course, we need to add to this the disastrous for mediation and unintended outcomes of the LASPO Act. The LASPO Act signalled a significant shift in government policy, which started during the formulation of the legal aid reforms and championed by the Minister of the day, Jonathan Gnoglie. Mediation was a thoroughly good thing and would provide a better forum for the resolution of many people's private law problems. Those private individuals who were previously eligible for legal aid were to be encouraged into mediation as the correct and the more supportive process. Unfortunately, as we know from the recent Ministry of Justice figures, there's a very different story to be told. Access to mediation has fallen off a cliff. The Freedom of Information questions to the Ministry of Justice revealed that between April and June 2012, there were 7,381 couples who attended MIAMS in England and Wales. Over the same three-month period in 2013, the numbers fell to 3,854, a 47% drop. it doesn't get any better. The numbers of couples starting family mediation sessions fell from 3,564 to 2,623 over the same time period, a decline of 26%. And those declines were most apparent in some of our largest urban centres, where we know there is real demand for mediation, for advice. Brighton, 41%, Leeds, 30%, London, 27%. We also know, anecdotally but worryingly, that conversions are significantly down. So the small number of people who are attending information sessions, many less are going on to access mediation proper. So, contrary to the hope that mediation figures would rise significantly, are the very stark facts. To be successful, mediation has to be seen by the parties involved as a viable, fair and credible alternative to court process. And it can't be a surprise to anyone involved in the family justice system that as a consequence of restricting access to justice in divorce and private law family matters, referrals to mediation have gone down. It doesn't mean that those cases have been resolved, or those families in the main are simply not being helped. One of the fatal flaws of the Lascaux Act thinking was in believing that taking lawyers out of the process, you would increase access to mediation. What we all know is that the involvement of good family solicitors increased the number of people willing and able to access mediation as a resolution mechanism. The figures from Surrey National Family Mediation show a 60% drop in the lawyer referrals received by the service since April 2013. And the national NFM figures are even starker, a 67% fall off in solicitor referrals comparing April to June 2012, the same period this year. Often, without being armed with legal advice and the support and encouragement of a trusted lawyer, mediation doesn't look like an attractive proposition to people with family law problems. Indeed, it does seem that there are a significant cohort of people who had previously been diverted into mediation who are now throwing themselves to the mercies of court. The figures from CAFCAS show an increase of 18% August to April in private law cases. Indeed, if I was a litigant in person, as most people now are, I'd probably go straight to court. The only upfront cost is the court fee, and many people are exempt from that. And then you have immediate and free access to the judiciary. The public has confidence and trust in the court process, the judiciary, and the outcomes they produce. This is a huge problem for mediation at a point where, as an industry, we are on our knees. Some might say that the implementation of the Children and Families Bill, likely to be in April of next year, which will bring, hopefully, a compulsory aspect to the MIOMs, will save the day. Indeed, much hope is placed in this, and I've been privileged to contribute to the President's Private Law Working Group, where significant effort has gone into trying to remedy this very real problem for clients and courts. Hopefully, it will bring more consideration of mediation, but it may, sadly, be too late for many mediation services who cannot survive until April. Right now, 8 mediation services, including some based in Sussex, Wiltshire, Hertfordshire and Lancashire, have announced their intention to close imminently. And there are another 30 or so known to be in serious danger. Many more solicitor-based services are quietly turning their practices towards fixed-fee legal services as the mediation work is just not coming through the door. Once the supplier base has been significantly lost, it's very difficult to see how it could be rebuilt. Mediation has had many false storms, and I think it's unlikely that solicitors' practices will be willing to make the considerable resource and financial investment to train their staff as mediators. When the not-for-profit sector services disappear, it's difficult to see by whom and how and when they will be replaced. There have been, of course, plenty of admirable innovations and huge commitment shown from and by mediation providers. including some 50 or so services that run at court mediation projects. And I'd dearly love to hear from the audience of great successes out there. And I'm sure there are some, but equally I'm sure they will have been hard fought and few and far between. We often hear of win-win situations. Well, I suggest that this is a lose-lose. Clients lose access to mediation and providers find their businesses collapsing. With no apparent change, providers can't, or perhaps won't, in some, hang around. They and their skills are likely to be lost for good. The simple fact is that mediators and mediation industry has had the rug pulled from beneath their proverbial feet. Government has paid lip service to mediation, but has denied the very fundamentals it needs to survive: public awareness, education, accessibility. I don't suggest that these have been intended consequences, but they are the consequences nonetheless. The problem for us all is that this needs urgent and early action. Clearly, all the indicators are leading to a conclusion that something has failed. We need to redress the situation urgently and diligently. I'd suggest we need a task force with a clear remit, and more importantly, the backing of government to get something done. Perhaps some of the savings that have been made from the non-access budget for legal aid mediation could be put towards a government campaign to increase awareness. Going back to my first point, the representative bodies and the quasi-regulators also need to take the bull by the horns and sort out a proper structure for the mediation industry. I'm sure there is more that can be done by these bodies, individuals and services, to promote mediation. Recently, when discussing the drop in referrals to mediation, Lord McNally talked about a hiccup. But I would diagnose a much more chronic and possibly fatal condition. Family mediation is on the operating table. Its future hangs in the balance. And without serious and appropriate intervention, the patient may never awake. How, ladies and gentlemen, in these circumstances, could it possibly be seen as fit for purpose? Thank you.